accession number 32297, reel 2.
And you're like?
John Dixon, reel 2. So after your inoculations, what was the kind of next step that they introduced you to? Would it be, I was thinking, would it be drill probably?
Well, I think it was really what we would call today a sort of square bashing course. We learned to drill and we learned to march. This was at Leon Solon, and we were only there for a month, and it was just an acclimatization period, really. We had certain lectures. Can't quite remember what they were, but anyway, we used to salute the white ensign being run up and all that sort of thing. We got very, very proud, and very quickly, you know, people laugh about square bashing and drill, but within a week or two, you began to enjoy it. It was quite amazing. I can't quite explain this because, you know, you were, oh dear, we've got to go and do this and all this drill, but you, when you got quite good at it, you became quite proud, and it was good. But anyway, during this period, we knew that we were going to go to HMS St Vincent, which was a great big old barracks blocks in Gosport, and it was really where it was going to be tough, really tough, tough naval discipline. And the chief petty officer there, and you've probably heard this name already, Chief Petty Officer Wilmot, and we were all terrified of him before we actually got there, because he was just a really strict discipline, and everybody that ever went to St Vincent will all tell you about Wilmot.
So his reputation was already well.
Oh yes, his reputation was on the line, you know, for weeks, months, years ahead. But an incredible man, incredible man. and so we were in fear and trembling of when we had to go to St Vincent, which we did. At the end of January 43.
So that first month, is it really just an induction to naval life that you did at Dale? Is that what it really is? Is it just to kind of induct you into the Navy?
Yes, I think it was, you learnt that you were divided into watches. You were port watch or starboard watch. One watch was on duty one day, and the other watch was on duty the next day. Each watch was divided into two parts, so you were part one of the watch, or part two, or part. And then the actual duties that you had to do, the chores that you had to do, you probably came round once every 4 days when you were the duty part of the duty watch. If you were the non-duty watch, that's when you were allowed to go ashore. And you've heard this expression before, you go ashore. You don't go ashore, you walk out of the gate. But it basically means that you're on leave until you had to get back on board at night.
So with the elements there, are we looking at very sort of basic elements of learning about naval life, the structure, what you have to select, how you divide it up, that sort of thing?
Yes, and the other thing, can't really remember the details about the rum issue, because there was a rum issue, but as of course we were too young. I think you had to be 20 before you were entitled to a rum issue, and if you were 20 and if you decided you didn't want the rum issue, you would get paid an extra 3 pence a day, I think. I'm not quite sure of all the details of that, but I never qualified for the rum issue. But it was an enormous part of naval life. I think 11 o'clock every morning, wherever you were, ashore or afloat or whatever, the pipe came over up spirits, and then that's when the rum was issued. And of course it was an enormous part of naval tradition. I feel quite sad that they stopped it.
What were your messing arrangements at Daedalus?
I think there was a mess hall. I don't know what we called it, but I think it was like a cafeteria, I suppose. You just sort of lined up, got your food, and sat at a table somewhere, and and you had your own knife, fork, mug and spoon, and way beside you if you lost it, sort of thing. The food there was quite good. But when we got to St. Vincent, it was a different story. But we'll talk about that later.
How was the move from Daedalus to St. Vincent?
Well, we knew the date, and I think it was obviously the end of January, because we just had the 4 weeks at Lee. And we were ploughed in the back of a 3-ton truck, more than one truck, obviously. But off we went. And all our kit bags, by then... I think we just had one big kit bag to put all our stuff in. All our civilian clothes, by the way, and our civilian suitcases had all been sent home. As soon as you got into your uniform, everything else had to be sent home. So we just had the uniform that we were issued with in a great big kit bag, and there was a special way of packing it, as we were supposedly told. Anyway, and the kit bag had your name and your number on the outside. And this is the first time we ever met Wilmot. I can always remember this. We all arrived at St. Vincent in this small parade ground at the back of these terrible old Victorian building. No, even older than Victorian. Terrible old building. And there we were on this parade ground, all milling about like a... well, I don't know what, complete rabble. And all our kit bags had been chucked out of another truck into a huge pile on the side of the... and we were told to go and find your kit bag. Well, of course, it was like a load of ants all swarming round this bit, and a voice suddenly, "Stand where you are!" And there was this Wilmot. And all you could see was steel-rimmed glasses, a great big mouth. He'd got very few teeth left. and he said, "Stand still." And he said, "I've never seen anything like this." He said, "Future naval officers," he said, "you look like a crowd of pregnant seasick wrens, and you've only come across the Gosport Ferry or something like this." And we stood there, absolutely petrified, and he said, he picked about six blokes, you and you, on the kit bags. And these poor unfortunate lads went onto the kit bags, and they picked them up one by one and shouted out your name, which was written on the kit bag, and you doubled across and got it. But that was the first. But it was the way the job was done. He said he'd never seen such a shower in all his life.
Was he chief instructor then at that?
He was the chief, in charge of discipline. He was a chief gunner's mate, which is as high as you could get in the lower ranks, apart from if you've got your warrant. But he was a chief petty officer gunner's mate. And a gunner's mate in the Navy in those days was the top you could be, because gunnery was the big thing. And the story is, and I'm sure it's true, that early in the war, during the Battle of Britain, he had a Lewis gun, an old Lewis gun, mounted on the top of one of the buildings. And there was an air raid, and he was supposedly to have shot down a German bomber with this Lewis gun. Now, I find it hard to believe, because to shoot anything down with a Lewis gun was a bit difficult. But... that was the reputation he had. But he terrified us. He terrified me and most of us. But one of my friends now, who went back to St. Vincent, having failed his pilot's course, and went back there to wait being trained as an observer, he was lucky. While he was waiting, he acted as Wilmot's dog, as we called him. In other words, he was his runaround. And he said, "Wilmot was the kindest and most considerate man when it came to dealing with youngsters like us." And another story I heard about him was that he could remember you. Now, how he could remember all these hundreds of faces, I can't believe it. But this chap says that, having got his wings, got his commission, and years later he was on the Gosport Ferry coming back, And there was Wilmot with his bicycle, because he lived ashore, and he was got his bicycle, and he looked at this young officer, and he said, "Ah," he said, "Richmond," he said, "yes, I remember you, how are you now?" But whether this is true, I don't know. It was just, it's something I've read.
But he certainly has a reputation amongst all of the people who were underneath him at St. Vincent, doesn't he?
Well, I can only liken him to, there was somebody at Sandhurst, wasn't there? There was a regimental sergeant major at Sandhurst who every young officer remembered as being the disciplinarian. But by God, if we moved.
Can you tell me about the accommodation? Because you briefly described it, but what was St. Vincent?
What at St. Vincent? Well, it was I think they were 3 or 4 storey buildings. I believe they were built as accommodation for French prisoners of war in Nelson's day. Couldn't have been, could it? I don't know. But they're very, very old buildings. And there were like dormitories on each floor, polished lino and that sort of thing. And again, you had 2-tier bunks. And part of your chores when you were duty watch was polishing the floors with mops and things, and polishing the steps and all those sort of things. It was real tough.
Did you receive kind of regular inspections of your accommodation?
Oh yes. There's always, I don't know whether they were captain's rounds or commander's rounds, but and how often that took place, I'm not sure. But you had to stand by your beds. And this troop came round, the petty officer, the leading hand, and then the commander or somebody. And woe beside you if things weren't right. You had to put it right immediately. But I think the thing I remember most, and most people will probably bear this out, the food was appalling. It was dreadful. We had to go on what we called mess decks, which were down below. And you were long tables, and you sat at so many to each table, and you had to take it in turns. When you were called cook of the mess, you weren't a cook, you didn't cook it, but your job was to go to the hatch or wherever this food was being served, and you had a huge tray with all the meat or whatever it was bunged into this tray, and you had to bring it back to your table, and you, as the mess cook that day, you had to dole it out to your mates on the table, and some of it was pretty atrocious stuff, you know. And then, having eaten the food, you as an individual had to clean your own knife, fork, mug and spoon and whatever, but the cook of the mess had to scrub out these huge trays and polish them and make them look, you know, just so. And the water that you had to wash them up in was usually half cold. So it was an atrocious job. It really was horrible. And the food was, well, but for the fact that we were always hungry, I mean, you wouldn't have eaten it. But
what was wrong with it?
Well, it was badly cooked, and it was unappetizing to look at, and but it was just, you know, like stodge. But there we were.
What was your reasoning that why it was so bad? Because obviously at Daedalus you said it was fairly good.
Well, that wasn't too bad. I suppose different way of cooking, different. The facilities here at St. Vincent were not conducive to good grub, but we survived. And of course there was always a canteen, there was a naffy somewhere, so if you couldn't eat the grub, you just shoved it in the pig bin, washed up your plate, and you went off to the naffy and hopefully had enough money to buy a Mars bar or something, or whatever the equivalent was in those days.
What kind of type of things could you get in the naffy?
Well, there was very limited, obviously, because sweets and things were rationed in those days. I honestly can't remember too much about that. But there were, I mean, mainly the naffy was for buying personal things like razor blades, toothbrush, toothpaste and that sort of thing, rather than food. But if they'd got food, and you could sometimes buy the odd tin of food, tin of fruit or something, but I mean, such things were very, very hard to come by in wartime Britain. So it was quite a treasure if you could get anything like that. The other thing, going back to these terrible mistakes in St Vincent, was the cockroaches. You've heard about these, have you? Well, the place was alive with these blooming cockroaches. They would crawl up the walls, and being the depths of winter, there was a lot of condensation in these old buildings. And you'd often be sitting there trying to eat your food, and there were cockroaches going up and down the wall. They didn't hurt you, but as long as they didn't fall into the food. and I mean, when you were really bored, you could have competitions of how many you could kill, but cockroaches.
Can I take you back a little bit with, obviously, we mentioned inspections, but were you instructed on how to lay out your kit?
Oh, yes. Yes, everything had to be just so. Yeah, and you had to tuck your blankets in and just so. Oh, no, you actually folded your blankets. And they, everything had to be in exact space on the bed, so that the whoever came round to inspect could check that you'd got all your kit. And that was another joke, because things like a hairbrush or a boot brush or something like that would often get missing, or you couldn't put your hand in. And when the inspection was come, you would arrange for a chap who was ahead of you being inspected to smuggle his brush quickly behind his back or down to you, so that when they got to you, you'd got a complete kit. But it all so petty, but I suppose it was a good sense of discipline.
Were they quite rigorous, though, the inspections that you had?
No, not really, I suppose. It was probably, you know, their bark was worse than their bite. You know, if you couldn't produce something, they'd shout at you and say, well, go and replace it, and that meant going to slots. You've heard the word slots, which was the naval stores where all your kit was issued. And, of course, you could buy extra items there, like if you needed extra pair of socks or woolly gloves or something, you could buy things. And so it meant that if you'd lost something, you had to go and buy another one. But if you got your name stamped on it properly, you didn't lose it.
Was there any occasions of a theft of items at all in that kind of environment?
No, I don't remember any. No, bearing in mind that we were a very mixed bunch, and some came from pretty, well, I'd say tough backgrounds. But another interesting point. We had in every course there were a few people that were what we call fleet entries. They were sailors who'd been at sea on destroyers or whatever, and I always remember one chap we had, he'd been on a destroyer and he knew everything. And they had applied to be trained as pilots, and those that were measured up joined our course. And normally those sort of people were often sort of put in charge of a few of us, because they knew the ropes, and they'd always got pale blue collars. And I can always remember this chap, can't tell you his name, but he was an absolute, he really thought he was a bee's knee. And he was on my part of the course that started flying. He came with me to Elmden to fly, and he'd been on the Atlantic convoys in a destroyer, so he knew what the Navy was like. As soon as he started flying, he was airsick. He could not cope with that, and they sent him back to the fleet. So we were, in a way, quite glad to see the back of him, but it's sad, really, isn't it, when you think?
But at that stage, obviously, when you were training at St Vincent, he knew all the wrinkles, didn't
he? He knew a good few of them, yes, and I mean, he could sort of put you wise on various things. But it was the way they did it, you know.
I take it with St Vincent, the drill continued on.
Oh, yes, the drill. And that was the other thing, because I don't know how many there were in each squad, probably 30 of you in each class, I don't know, call it a class. And you did a lot of drill out on the big, huge parade ground. And everybody had to take a turn at being in charge, and you had to drill the squad. And you had to stand still, and you ordered them about all around this huge parade ground. You had to shout like mad to make sure that they behaved. And if you had a good crowd in your class, well, they did behave and they did obey you, because they knew they'd got their turn coming up. But it was quite good fun. Another interesting point is you've heard of the Channel Dash, the swordfish that were shot down when they went for the on the German ships. 18 men in 6 aircraft went out, and 5 survived. One of the pilots who survived was Brian Rose, Sub Lieutenant Brian Rose, who was injured. He got a bad damaged back, and of course he got a DSO. So a Sub Lieutenant RNVR with a DSO was quite a rarity, and he came to St Vincent as our divisional officer while we were there. It was while he was recuperating, you see. I don't remember he had a great personality. He just basically stood there and looked very smart. And you had to report to him when your class was all ready. But when you think what he'd been through, and then a couple of years later, when he was better and he was flying again, killed in a Barracuda accident. So that's sad. His observer, who also survived, was Edgar Lee, who was out in Canada with us as a sort of staff officer out there. They were there, obviously, to boost our morale, I suppose.
And you would report to them once you'd taken your...
Oh, wait, yeah, when you'd drilled your... or you had to get your squad ready for inspection, put it that way. And then you march very smartly up to the divisional officer and you saluted and you said, Class 3, ready for inspection, sir, or something. And he'd say, carry on. There we are.
I take it, John, obviously, because you'd done quite a bit of drill pre-joining the Fleet Air Arm. Did everybody adjust to it that easily? Or were there cases of people who couldn't manage it?
I think we all pretty well, we were all pretty fit, and I mean, I think we were all pretty intelligent, so we could do it quite well. But you've just triggered a memory now, and it makes me smile even when I think of it. Because in the post-war years, when I was flying, my CO there was Ralph Jameson, Lieutenant Commander Ralph Jameson, who was on the 44th pilot's course. Now, he was one of these lovely, lovely characters who... When you march, your left arm goes forward with your right foot, sort of, and he couldn't do it. and he just could not do it. And even, you know, as recently as 1957, he was leading our squadron. But he insisted he was the only one in step. Anyway, no, we were all pretty good at it, I think.
While you're there, how did the training start to differ? What was the types of things that you became a little bit more involved in at St Vincent?
Well, we were still... it was made very, very clear to us when we first went to Leon Solent that primarily we were sailors. Never mind the aeroplane, we were sailors. And in fact, in my case, it was 5 months after I joined up before I actually got my hands on an aeroplane. So we were sailors. So we learnt all the sort of sailors' things, even silly things like tying knots and splicing ropes. And well, we did a certain amount of sailing. We did sailing in cutters. We did rowing, rowing round the harbour.
How did that take place? How were you instructed in that? Was there somebody who would take you out?
Well, one of the petty officers, one of the old school, they would all take. They were all competent, and we'd all go out and learn these boat drill. Really, it was called, We didn't have any power boats to play about with, but we had these what we call cutters. They're like great big rowing boats with like four oars on either side, and you rowed these round, and eventually, if the weather was decent, you could put a sail up and you could sail. And you go off to some quiet part of the harbour and lie up for an hour or two while the chief had a cigarette. But it was that sort of thing. But we tied knots. At Vincent, they had one of these huge masts, and you've seen pictures of lads climbing masts and standing right on the top. We didn't have to do that. It was not compulsory, and they did have a safety net, if I remember. But you were encouraged to go up the mast in your own time. It was not part of a course or a drill or a lesson. But often in the evenings you'd see lads climb up the mast. I don't remember anybody going right to the very top, because it used to frighten me to go even halfway up.
Did you try it?
I tried it, but it didn't appeal to me very much. I don't like heights.
with the training when you were out in the cutter, how unpleasant was that at the time of year that you were training? Is it an easy thing to do?
I suppose it was together? February, March time. Well, by then I think we got used to the cold and the weather. I mean, we were pretty tough, I think, by then. I never have liked rowing much, you know. I find it a bit hard. But it was all sort of part of it. And then we had races. If you had two or three cutters and you had your mates in another boat, and you'd try and beat them. But it wasn't taken too seriously. What was taken seriously, which was stupid really, I think, you had all the weapons. You had Tommy guns, you had Lewis guns, you had pistols, you had rifles, you had a thing called a Lanchester, you had a Sten gun, and we had to learn how to strip them, to clean them, to reassemble them, and then eventually to go out on the range and fire them. We often used to say, well, we're going to be pilots. We're not supposed to do all this sort of thing. But it was all part of the drill. And then we had lectures on bombs and mines and depth charges and all that sort of thing. We did a lot of time doing navigation, aerial navigation. Of course, is what we really were interested in, but we also did ship navigation, how to steer a ship and allow for tides and that sort of thing. We did signals again, aircraft ship recognition. That was a bit of a giggle, because they had models, little models of ships, and they were on a table, but there was a screen about 6 foot in front of the table, so you couldn't see through it, but you had to stand on a chair, look over the screen, and the petty officer shone a torch on one of these little models, and you had to say what it was. And bearing in mind we had Japanese ships, we had Italian ships and German and our own ships, and you'd say, right, I'll sink that one, and you turned out you'd sunk Prince of Wales or something. Except that was already sunk by then.